Dick. So what you just said, Paul, is the new direct broadcast satellite. You said it has a 60-foot dish, 60 foot, not 6 meters, 60 feet. Now, because a dish, to be fully effective, has to have something like 10th of a wavelength of surface accuracy, almost all of the direct broadcast satellites operate at KU band, which is around 12 or so gigahertz, 12, 13 gigahertz, where the wavelength is approximately 1 inch, a little bit less than an inch. So therefore, a tenth of a wavelength is going to be a tenth of an inch of surface accuracy across a 60-foot diameter. At first, that sounds almost impossible, Paul. Now, maybe the 60-foot dish is a very large spherical surface, not a parabolic. Let me drop it. It might be a little bit like Arecibo. Arecibo is not a parabolic dish. It's a spherical dish, and as you move the feed on, you're lighting up different portions of that 1,000-foot diameter dish in Puerto Rico and aiming the beam in various directions. Now, maybe they have multiple horns and making multiple beams and only using a fraction of that 60-foot dish at a time. But if they're using the whole 60-foot dish simultaneously on one 12 gigahertz frequency, I could go through the mathematics of that, and I think we're talking about lighting up one square mile of the Earth. That sounds like much too sharp a focus, so the numbers are not coming out quite right. So give me a few more facts on this one if you happen to know, Paul. WS2N, KQLAW.
Yeah, I'm not sure if it's parabolic or not. And it looks at, I'm looking for a picture of it now. I'll find it. The way they look like they do it, I'm not really sure. But I mean, they have hundreds of, up 100 of these pinpoint locations. So I don't know if it's doing phase shifts or changing the beam direction electronically, you know, thousands of times a second, or millions of times a second. I'm not sure how they're doing it, but it's that type of thing. Same with the military one I remember reading about. So it's not like one signal is going down. I think a lot of things are coming down at the same time. They have like 70, like on this thing, I think it's 70 transponders for one satellite. Plenty of power too, I think, with some generating 1,800 watts, big solar panels. Solar panels are, you know, like 100 feet wide or something. Back to you, I got to look for information about the biggest one and a couple of the other things. Back to you, Dick.
You believe the dish is 60 foot in diameter. You believe it might be parabolic, possibly spherical. And the only way, if it's a spherical dish, that you can name a large number of individual locations, 11 locations or 72 transponders, the way you get individual locations with a pure reflector antenna is to have multiple feed horns in just the right locations. Each feed horn reflects off that dish and then gives you a pencil beam aimed at a particular spot on the Earth. Or, it's possible what looks like a parabolic surface is a whole lot of individual emitters, and it's really one very large phased array. And now you're electronically steering. But if you're really mechanically steering, you have to move a feed horn in just the right spot in front of the dish. And 60 feet in diameter, and as I said, most direct broadcast satellites, let me drop it, are operating around 12 gigahertz, 1 inch wavelength. So a tenth of an inch of surface accuracy out of a 60-foot diameter reflector that was all folded up inside that spacecraft and then got properly deployed in space to that accuracy. Wow. So this 60-foot diameter direct broadcast satellite, I'd like to know the name of that one, Paul. I'd like to look that one up. That sounds like a brand new breakthrough. If half of what you're telling me is true, this is a bit of a breakthrough as I see it, Paul. WS2N, KQLAW.
Quick comment, Dick.
Oh, okay. And it's just the satellite itself is tremendous. Yeah, go ahead, John.
AC2WGB. It's a little hard to believe, Dick, but I have a gentleman on the chat room who just emailed a quick message. He would like you to, he's been listening for off and on for 20 years. He would like you to give a little bit of your history, what you do, what type of work you did. In other words, who are you, where'd you come from, and what do you know? When you get a chance, you can give a quick introduction to your background. If you can, KC2WGB. Back to you, Dick.
And the name of the satellite, DirecTV 15, and they launched two at the same time, both for DirecTV. Another one was called Sky Mexico 1. Back to you, Dick.
So DirecTV number 15, Sky Mexico number 1. Okay, maybe that's enough for me to pin this thing down. Interesting. It turns out that I walked out of college and thought I would never work in microwaves and walked into a company called Airborne Instruments Laboratory way back in 1964, the Dark Ages. June 15, 1964, and worked for them for 35 solid years and then retired and opened up my own business. But during those 35 years, I had lots of experience on the EA-6B standoff jammer of the Navy. So I worked on that aircraft on and off for about 10 years, but an awful lot of my time was spent on the B-1B bomber, both B-1A that got canceled by Carter, and then the B-1B that got reinitiated by Reagan. I guess I was on that program for about 25 years altogether. Let me drop. So I did lots of work on high-power Navy transmitters, high-power Air Force transmitters, and also did some work on the SR-71, the Blackbird, that Mach 3.2 aircraft. And that's got some very fancy antennas that can pin down the location of an emitter to the nearest 1 degree in azimuth and about 2 or 3 degrees in elevation. As you fly by somebody's territory, you continuously keep measuring the direction of arrival of the signal to the nearest 1 degree. That allows you to pin down the location of that thing on the ground to the nearest a kilometer or so, even though you're 90,000 feet up. A really fancy airplane. So I spent most of my time designing antennas commercially and lining up anechoic chambers. As a ham radio operator, I built the strip line parallel kilowatt amplifier for 432. That's April and May QST 1972. The strip line amplifier tripler, February 1970, ham radio. The 12-foot stress parabolic dish, that was August 1972 QST. Let's see, did Apollo reception with homebrew equipment on Apollo 15 and 16. That was the, let me think. That article is called Houston, this is Apollo. Let me drop. Yeah, that article was June 72 QST. August 72, 1972 of QST is the 12-foot stressed parabolic dish antenna that I had developed. But I guess I got the most amount of mileage out of that strip line parallel kilowatt amplifier. There's quite a few thousand of those in operation. Two separate companies came along and actually started producing them. As I said, April and May, or was it February, March? I think it's April and May, QST, on the parallel strip line kilowatt amplifier for 432. And there was one other article, outdoor range ratiometry technique for antenna measurements. Keep a minute, forgetting what month and year that was. Roughly 1976. And I think it's the February, March, April issue. If you do a QST search with my call letters as a search, you'll find each one of these articles. So I played around with a lot of reasonably high power transmitters, fancy receivers, fancy antennas. I've got two towers on the property for most of the last 40 years. Let's see, I've been using... I put up my first 80-foot tower on a piece of rental property where I stayed there for 4.5 years in Smithtown. And that was a good trick, to talk the landlord into allowing me to put an 80-foot tower on the property so I could operate on 2 meters and 432.
432 and 2 meters are my favorite bands. And I've also done some fairly long distance work on 10 gigahertz from home, as well as mobile. So I have fiddled with quite a bit of RF. Let me drop it. Of all that I know about electronics, radio electronics, I think about a third of it came from my ham radio experience. About half of it came from my 35 years of experience in AIL, Edwin Instruments Laboratory. They ran an extremely good radio school, unofficially. By that I mean that place was run like a college in its heyday under John Dyer. John Dyer was the president of the company for a good number of years, a ham radio operator. I got quite friendly with him. And he was Admiral Byrd's radio operator. He designed the equipment that Admiral Byrd used during many of his expeditions to the South Pole. So fascinating guy. But that company, AIL, for the 55 years that it ran, almost every single product it made had something to do with radar and electronic countermeasures. Almost every single product. And I worked for about four or five of those different departments. In fact, for a while, I was the engineering manager of spectrum analyzer products on the commercial division that I worked for 6 years. So that's where the experience is coming from. That's what you're hearing. Just that I was in the right place at the right time. You talk to people who have worked for three magic companies on Long Island. Let me drop it. Talk to anybody who's ever worked at the Wheeler Laboratory. Harold Wheeler, the Wheeler Laboratory, was an antenna company, I think in Syosset. You talk to anybody who's ever worked with Harold Wheeler, and they thought they were in engineering heaven. Henry Jasek also had the Jasek Laboratory making antennas. Anybody ever worked for him or for his right-hand man, Dave Bressler? They thought they were in engineering heaven. Airborne Instruments Laboratory eventually purchased the Jasek Laboratory, made Henry Jasek the vice president of the company and the head of the antenna development department. And I've had lots of conversations with Henry over the years. Henry is the editor of one of the best antenna books in the world, the Jasek Antenna Engineering Handbook. And I interfaced with Henry every other couple of days. So as you can tell, I was in the right place at the right time. I talked to some pretty fancy people. I used to spend my lunch hours we had a break period between 9:30 and 9:45 in the morning, and I would go visit various people in various departments and talk to these people that are doing interesting work, roam around the company, or stay after hours and do work with them. So that's where the experience you're listening to is coming from. And the world's largest indoor anechoic chamber at Edwards Air Force Base. It was originally called, let me drop it. It was originally called the AFAF, A-F-A-F, stand for Air Force Anechoic Facility, which eventually got renamed as the Benny Field Anechoic Facility. This chamber is 1.5 acres, 7 stories high, completely sealed chamber. You put a whole great big B-1 bomber in there and rotate it and make measurements. When that chamber was first tuned up, they were having quite a bit of trouble. And I'm one of the guys that taught them how to tune that chamber. I also did some rather exciting work out at the Rome Air Development Center in New York, where they've got two mountains 1.5 miles apart. And they put the transmitters on one mountain, and they put the aircraft, full-size aircraft, on top of a pedestal on the other mountain, and rotate them back and forth. And that uses a very accurate antenna measuring technique called antenna ratiometry. And that's the article that I wrote for QST Magazine in 1976. And it was also an IEEE presentation in New York City. I guess that was 1974, I think, is that presentation. And that's also a QST article, as well as a IEEE article. So I've been fiddling with antennas, towers, transmitters, receivers, transmission lines. Just now, I put it all together, you can say 40-some-odd years of experience. When it comes to all the electronic experience you've run into, John, you've been working on some real high-power electronics. And I'll bet you've been doing that for considerably more than 30 years, am I right? KC2WGB, K2RW, go ahead, John. By the way, John and I are almost the same age. You got it, John.
Yes, Dick, you're right. Quite a bit, about 52 years in the profession, and yeah, some nice projects and some wonderful work, a lot of experience, but there were a lot of people whose shoulders I stood on, and I know you feel the same way, but loved every minute of it, and wouldn't want to change a thing. Very happy with how it worked out, just like you, and you can't buy experience. You know, you got to put your time in, and sure, you know a lot of things, and you've been a lot of places. So, and by the way, Chris sent a note. He'd like to thank you very much for that little quick revisit of your life. He was just wondering, and it's just amazing if he's been listening for that time that he hasn't heard all of this, because you've mentioned so many things of projects you worked on and things you've done, you know, as I have on a few. But very good. Back to you, Dick, KC2WGB.
One of the things that I've said quite a few times is that I'm extremely disappointed with the way our electrical engineering schools, both in the United States and most of the foreign countries, the way we teach wireless electronics. I'm very disappointed. We don't do it anywhere near as well as we could. Our computer science courses, they keep it up to date. But the electromagnetic theory course, the Maxwell's equation course, the fields and wave course, call it what you like. They set the curriculum for that in roughly 1947, and it's done very little changing of it ever since. And as such, you'd like to believe that a guy who studies that subject, he wants to major in wireless electronics. He takes all the courses in his college, has the bachelor's degree, master's degree, and maybe even the doctorate degree. And you'd like to think he can walk out of there and design antennas. And the answer is almost absolutely no. How can you get an antenna engineer? You get a guy who has really got a strong passion for the subject. He's been fiddling with it as a ham radio operator for a good number of years, going to some good schools and understood the basics that they taught him. And then he worked for a company that's doing real antenna design. Let me drop. And he's either closely associated with or working in the antenna development laboratory of that company. And after about 10, 15, maybe 20 years of apprenticeship, it's unofficial apprenticeship, he's in the department alongside the people, the white-haired guys that are doing it, who have got 20 and 30 years of experience. He's alongside of them, and he's watching quite a few projects. And under those conditions, you wait 10 or 15 years, and if the guy survives that, you've now got an antenna engineer. It doesn't have to be that way. I have taken a number of really smart mechanical engineers during the last 10 years who were sufficiently interested in the subject, and I taught them antenna engineering, at least for a particular class of antennas that are running at 915 megacycles that are used on RFID interrogators and RFID readers. You could give a guy two-thirds or one-half of the information he needs to design antennas for that frequency region. You can teach him how to do that in a couple of months. But under normal circumstances, a real antenna designer, I think, takes 10 years of apprenticeship or more. You take a company called Airborne Instruments Laboratory. In its heyday, it had 1,050 degreed engineers. 1,050 engineers with a four-year degree or greater. Let me drop. Most of them electronic engineers, quite a few of them mechanical engineers. I would guess 80% of them electronic, 15% mechanical, and the rest are industrial and a few other kinds of engineering. But at least 80% of them were electronic engineers, 1,050 engineers. So we're talking about probably 800 electronic engineers in a company where every single product had something to do with radar, surveillance receivers, reconnaissance receivers, radar transmitters, receivers, rotary joints, antennas, radar, radar, radar. So you're either listening to radar by way of reconnaissance and surveillance receivers or generating the radars themselves. For 55 years, that company, Airborne Instruments Laboratory, did that. 800 electronic engineers. In the antenna engineering department, which in its heyday had 15 or 20 electronic engineers, antenna engineers, by my standards, only two-thirds of those guys had a real good warm feeling about how an antenna works, how to design one, how to fix it when it's not working, what's really going on inside. So we're talking about 10 or 15 engineers out of 1,000 in a company where every single product is an RF product, and 10 or 15 of those guys have a good working knowledge of antennas. And when it comes to radio electronics, let me drop. As you've heard me say so many times, you can have a gold-plated transmitter, a gold-plated receiver, the world's best transmission line, the world's best power supply, the world's best microphone and modulator and demodulator. You can hold this radio equipment. If you don't connect it to a good transmitting antenna on one end and a good receiving antenna on the other end, if you don't do that, you've got nothing. You could say the most important component, from one point of view, is the antenna. And we do such an extremely poor job of teaching antenna engineering in a useful engineering format, so the guy can walk out of that school whistling that tune. We do not do that. A large number of companies in the United States need antenna engineering.
I heard a comment.
They need antenna engineering. They can't hire it. They have to outsource it because they can't get those people. They're rather rare animals. And the few companies that have good antenna engineers, if they got half a brain, they do whatever is required to hold on to them, because that's an extremely rare bird. You take an enthusiastic. Let me drop.
That's the satellite's name for you too, Dick.
You take a really enthusiastic ham radio operator. He can learn antenna engineering, an awful lot of it, with his own hands. The schools do not teach it. And they should. If you guys, listening to my voice, decide to dig in, learn antennas, and you can do an awful lot of that work in your backyard to learn what's really going on, what works, what doesn't work, read the right books, take a couple of courses, talk to people who are doing it, and you become an antenna engineer, you'll be in demand. As a consultant with that skill, I've had to turn down work. There are times when too many people are making a request simultaneously. One of the companies I worked for as a consultant had 1,000 engineers. Another company had 1,000 employees, 1,000 employees. Of those 1,000 employees, 3 or 4 of them understood what radio was. And when I started working for them as a consultant, their needs were so great that I eventually ended up having a contract with 3 separate departments in that company running simultaneously. For a 6-month period of time, I had 3 simultaneous with 3 separate departments in the same company. Their need for antenna engineering and radio understanding was that deep, that need, and they couldn't fulfill it. They had the requests out to try to hire that people with that skill for 6 solid months and couldn't find it. So as you can see, because it is so poorly taught, let me drop. Because it's so poorly taught in all the schools that I know of, the books do a medium good job, the schools do a fairly mediocre job at best, there is such a drastic need for it, there are 20 wireless products being used in the United States right now. Cell phones are just one of the really big ones, 6.8 million cell phones in the world. There are more people with a cell phone, have access to a cell phone, than have access to a working toilet. Which is more important in the world? Cell phones are a little bit more important than toilets, it appears. Craziness. So, but there's 20 wireless products being used right now. And all of those products need wireless understanding of transmitters, receivers, and antennas. You dig into that subject, and you got you get moderately good skill at it, you will be in demand. People will beat a path to your door. They will cross your palm with silver, if you know what I mean. So, what do you believe is the solution to this, Wes? N2XJN, K2RIW?
N2XJN. Well, I'll take a few words. I'm far away from complimenting anybody. I'm not a people person. But I can tell you one thing. You maybe didn't notice that. You're doing it for 30-something years. But you actually have trained on the TechNet for all of those years. So many of people who never thought they're going to be good in antenna, good in radio, and good electronics, ladies and gentlemen. And also, what you actually did is you created a people interest, wondering, people trying to understand. I can say about myself, there was one time when you said about the Smith chart. And when you said about the Smith chart, I wanted just to see the Smith chart right in my living room. I wanted to touch the device, I want to see what's going on over there. I was attracted to it. I wonder, how many people over the years did you attract? How many new ham radio operators did you produce? John, maybe you can have a comment.
KC2WGV. Oh, I'm sure it's quite a few. I mean, after 30 years, and the attendance is quite sufficient on this net, I'm sure a lot of people were impressed with going a little further and maybe improving their skills, picking up their level. Oh, absolutely. And I don't think you can count the number of people. KC2WGV. Back to you, Dick.
You and I do get a fair number of letters from time to time, John, of people who say that, hey, I was tuning across the ham bands, I found this thing called the technical net and started listening. To them, it was fairly educational. It's of a format. It's kind of a loose format, but at least it is run by people who have a kind of a passion. I mean, their mission in life is education. Most of the people who meet here, there are people who develop a particular skill, and they, for fear of losing it, they hold it very close to the chest and only release the information very slowly, if at all, and just barely do what's required, if you know what I mean. You and I, John, and quite a few other people who meet on the technical net have come to the conclusion that when it comes to radio, there's a darn much to it. There's a darn many factors. There's so much more where that came from. We don't bother trying to hold the stuff close to our chest. We give it away free of charge. The one thing that we do, let me jump. We tell people that, hey, we're willing to dedicate 4 hours of our life every week for the last 32 and a half years, most of that anyhow, on Sunday night, doing a live give-and-take conversation on the subject in which we review some of our past war stories, we make some speculations as to where you can go in the future with it. We're willing to do that much dedication, and the total amount of hours that TechNet has been on the air is more than the total number of hours that Johnny Carson was on the air during his 30 years of the Tonight Show on NBC, essentially every night during the week, because we're on for 4 hours during the weekend, and he was on for, I guess, about an hour and a half or so each night when he was there. But our total exposure time is longer. So in that much time, quite a bit of information is transferred. Lots and lots of people come out of the woodwork saying, I've got experience on that subject, this is what I found. So it's a gathering of curious people sharing information and not worrying about it, but there's a limit. We're willing to do it as a live give-and-take conversation on Sunday night. Let me drop. But that does not mean that we are volunteering. Completely free consulting service written just because somebody writes us a letter. There's a limit. I mean, if you and I, John, said, hey, mail us as many letters as you want, we'll answer all your questions. you'd be snowed under. You can't do that. You gotta set a limit somewhere. We're willing to do it on a live conversation. And what John does with the mailbag, and there were times when he gets hundreds of answers, hundreds of questions in one particular week, and what he does is to select a couple of those that are of wide enough general interest that we believe it will help the most number of people. And we take one, two, three, four of those. But we can't offer free written consulting service. But you will get relatively free verbal real time, as long as you've got a ham radio license, can get on the air and talk to us by internet, IRLP, or direct radio through this particular pair of repeaters. We'll try to answer whatever question you got. And we don't guarantee 100% accuracy, every realistic engineer. You've heard me say it so often. Let me drop. Every realistic engineer has to try to not take himself too carefully, too seriously. No matter how sincere you are, no matter how smart you are, you're going to make some mistakes. That's a given. Nobody bats a thousand. It's hard. I can listen to some of those recordings on the TechNet website, amateurradio.tangovictor, and I listen to my own recordings occasionally. And I hear myself saying, you do this, and this, and you get a left-hand circular polarization. Well, the right answer was right hand. I occasionally get things like that backwards, spoonerisms or whatever. No matter how hard you try, you're going to make some errors. Do the best you can. You laugh at the errors and try to go on and use it as a learning experience. There are people who will listen to some of my pronouncements. They'll listen very carefully, and they'll find something that's an error. And they'll say, hey, this guy's a charlatan. I'm not going to listen to him anymore. But that's your choice. Nobody is perfect. We occasionally make errors. But because all of our statements are recorded and can be played back, and people listen to those recordings, and when they find errors, they let me know about it. You could say it is peer-reviewed material, and therefore we get a chance to correct those errors. We get a chance to occasionally say, yeah, what we said 2 weeks ago on the so-and-so subject, we really should have said such and such. We get a chance to do that. And there are occasionally things that are controversial. I mean, some of my opinions as to what goes on inside of an antenna. Let me drop. At the really basic level, there are charged particles. Call them electrons. Call them holes and electrons, if you like. Nucleuses, ions. There are charged particles moving around inside of an antenna. Nobody has ever seen a molecule. No one has ever seen an atom. By way of a scanning tunneling microscope, you get a kind of a hint by way of that bumpy-looking landscape. Get a sort of a hint as to where the mass center of each of those molecules or atoms are located, but you never really see the real thing. So therefore, the best you can do is come up with a mental model as to what you think is going on. And now you apply the mental model to the real world and find out how well it fits. And if all the experiments you've done, the model seems to fit, and then you use the model and now make projections of other things you can do with it. That's exactly what science does. When it comes to nuclear science, nobody's ever seen a nuclear piece of material. But you've got some kind of a mental model. What goes on inside of a particle accelerator? You're using man-made models that are continuously evolving as you find out more and more of what's going on. So I've got a model as to what goes on inside of an antenna. I use that model for my antenna design. Quite a bit of the time it works. Not always. Sometimes there's really funny things going on. But with the way that signal bounces around inside of a large periodic antenna is not quite as simple as it sounds. And when it comes to some of the antennas I've worked on, where most people think an antenna with 3% bandwidth, the best you're going to do with the band edges, you're going to hit a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio, and you may get a great standing wave ratio in the center of the band, but at the band edges of a 3% bandwidth, it's going to hit 2-to-1 standing wave ratio. That is the prior art. Let me drop. You got all kinds of computer modeling programs, which in some cases help a lot. But there's a whole class of antennas that I have worked on in the last 10 years where the computer modeling programs do not work. And by way of pure tinkering of the ham radio type, by using a very well-calibrated vector network analyzer, and you just... with tuning tools and pieces of copper tape at 915 megacycles, and you're plastering these pieces of copper tape onto a sheet of mylar. And by putting pieces of copper tape in funny places and watching what happens on the screen, where on the screen is a dual display and you're looking at gain and standing wave ratio simultaneously displayed, they're usually in conflict. Quite often you do something to an antenna that makes the standing wave ratio real good, the gain falls off. Or correspondingly, you do something to make the gain real good, the standing wave ratio degrades. But if you're watching both displays simultaneously, if you tinker just right, occasionally you'll find a crazy piece of copper tape in the right place will make the gain go up and make the VizWire get better simultaneously. And once you see that on the screen and you keep doing it, you eventually come up with an antenna, which I did, which has got 6 dB of gain, and it doesn't exceed 1.05 to 1 standing wave ratio across 902 to 928 megs, 26 megs of bandwidth, at a center frequency of 915, and it doesn't exceed 1.05 standing wave ratio. That exceeds all of the Chu Wheeler criteria, and it exceeds the Bode-Fano criteria as to what's the greatest bandwidth you can get with the lowest possible standing wave ratio. It exceeds those well understood criteria. Because all of those criteria, all of that previous work was done with computer modeling. Let me drop it. Where everybody came up with an equivalent circuit for the antenna, which is made out of inductors and capacitors with various combinations, they assume the inductors and capacitors stay fixed in value as you sweep the frequency. With very skinny antennas that are of previous history, that is true. When it comes to very wide conductor antennas, the apparent resistor and apparent capacitors slightly change as a function of frequency. And if you've got them laid out just right, you can make that balance where the standing wave ratio across that bandwidth stays extremely low and the gain stays high. And as such, when you finally get that antenna and you see that display on the spectrum analyzer and you file for a patent on it and the patent gets granted and it becomes a product that's being manufactured, and then you try to computer model that working antenna, and the computer model says, no, it can't do that. You say to yourself, what's going on here? It turns out the computer model with skinny elements, finite element analysis, works very well. But when the elements on the antenna become extremely wide, where the number of little triangles you have to draw in order to really simulate that antenna, let me drop it. When the number of triangles gets up to, let me pick a number, 1,000 triangles, and now you're trying to use the computer program to take 1,000 individual elements of complex numbers as a matrix and invert that matrix. The computer program cannot handle that. The currently available computer programs cannot model the antennas that I have built. And I didn't build them by way of a model. I built them by pure ham radio tinkering in front of a well-calibrated vector network analyzer. There's a whole class of antennas out there. You could say the world doesn't yet know about it. You guys know about it because you've been hearing me brag about it from time to time. And I can show you the patent where you could read about the antenna and you look at the funny thing. It's a three-element Yagi, but it's not a three-element Yagi like anything you've ever seen. It's got funny whiffs and funny little bumps in funny places. I can't even give you a good explanation for why that particular bump in that particular place does all of that magic, but it does. There's some kind of funny cross-coupling happening, and the signal, the current flowing on that sheet of metal, changes in just the right way as a function of frequency being swept, so that the cross-coupling between the elements is just right, so the standing wave ratio stays low and the gain stays high. I'm having trouble coming up with a theory of operation for the antennas that I've worked on that were found by pure ham radio tinkering. And all the schools that we have tell you that the computer modeling is the be-all, end-all, and they spend all of their life doing computer modeling. Essentially, every single antenna company out there brags about the fact we model it first, then we build it. With that philosophy, they will never find this whole class of antennas that I am finding. And no matter how many times I say this, no matter how many antenna engineers, they look at me saying that, hey, that's so different from everything I've ever heard. Everything up.
Repeater, time out.
They say it's so different from everything they've ever heard with all the classes they've taken. They assume that I'm crazy. They may be right. And they don't pay attention to it. They don't believe it. Ain't that crazy? It's a little bit too radical. That's what happened with that parallel kilowatt amplifier, the strip line 432 megacycle parallel kilowatt amplifier. I first submitted that article to Ham Radio Magazine, and the editor then was Jim Fisk. And he knew that at microwave frequencies, at UHF frequencies, when you use more than one tube, they have to be used in push-pull in order to divide the capacitance. Everybody said that for the previous 20 years. And he sees this article where this crazy guy, RIW, is putting two tubes in parallel. He was positive it was a nut paper, and he turned it down. And yet lots of guys were building it at that time. and bragging about the fact that, hey, I'm getting 700 watts out of this thing when I put 1,000 watts into it. 70% efficiency in the Class C mode of two inexpensive tubes, four CX250Bs, being used in a very wide piece of strip line, and they're running in parallel. And the tubes do not have to be matched. You can turn off one of the filaments if you want to and get enough power output after you readjust the tuning and loading controls. They do not have to be matched. The two tubes act like one composite tube in that amplifier. QST published it as a breakthrough article, a QST extra. For the next 5 years of his life, Jim Fisk kept mailing me letters saying, please forgive me, please send us another article. He didn't recognize what he was looking at when he turned it down. He thought it was a nut paper because it was so radical. To a degree, he was right. So, sometimes what looks like crazy isn't always crazy. I've had some fun with that, as you can tell. I've had some fun bragging about it. But that particular amplifier, the parallel kilowatt amplifier, there's quite a few thousand of them in operation right now.
Repeater, time out.
There were at least two companies that I know about that were manufacturing those things with my permission, and I wasn't getting any royalties on it. That's okay. Lots of hams were using them, and we're fairly happy with them. It's a 3-pound amplifier that puts out 700 watts using the tubes in ICA service. Frank Toner, F9FT, used higher voltage and higher drive power, and he managed to get 2,000 watts out of that amplifier, really pushing the tubes. But what I'm getting at is that you've got to be careful on judging whether or not something is good or not so good just because it breaks the tradition. There's a lot of tradition when it comes to antenna testing. The way antenna testing laboratories are run gave me an awful lot of slack when I was trying to do that tuning up of that chamber out at Edwards Air Force Base. And if it wasn't for me working on the second shift at 2 o'clock in the morning, in which we did things that we're not supposed to be allowed to do, is where we found the breakthrough to make the chamber work better. But I was breaking the tradition of the way things are done. There's a 40-year tradition as to how they do testing in an anechoic chamber. Let me drop. And I had other ways of thinking about what's going on, and they were giving me a lot of flack at first. So, I forget what the point I was going to make with all this. As you can tell, I've got an internal model as to how the transmitter works. I've got an internal model in my head as to how an antenna works. And most of the time, that model for me works. And various people have said, maybe I should put it into a book. Maybe I should. Also, I should put it into a kind of a lecture with pictures. When you see the actual diagrams of the display off of these network analyzer screens, or the display of the gain in an anechoic chamber, or when you see the biggest pleasure that the guy at Simple Technology, there was a guy at Simple Technology that was working on a RFID reader. Let me drop it. And at the time, when it comes to barcode readers, that's what Simple was making most of their money on, barcode readers. Their biggest competition was always the Intimec company. So there was a great big electronic show coming up in Chicago where Intimec and Simple would be displaying their latest products essentially side by side. And so barcode readers have been around for quite a few years, and now these brand new products coming along were RFID readers. And the RFID reader made by the Intimec company had a state-of-the-art antenna on the front end. It had a flat plate aimed straight forward that gave you the greatest possible area, because gain of an antenna is a function of area. So the flat plate gave you the greatest possible area. The engineer had used high dielectric materials to shrink down the size of the antenna. So if you use dielectric material of 10 ceramic material, and 1 over the square root of the dielectric constant means that you could change the size of the antenna by 3 to 1. Also, the RFID tags you want to read are really a dipole, and that dipole might be oriented horizontal, vertical, or somewhere in between. So he made it a circular polarized antenna. So by way of a circular polarized antenna, he knew that he could take a tag of any orientation and he could read it. Let me drop it. By way of the high dielectric materials, he could shrink down the size of the antenna. Didn't come up with any techniques to make it more broadband with in standing wave ratio. So it had a very good standing wave ratio in the center of the band, and at the edges of the band, the standing wave ratio was pretty high. And in order to legally transmit on that license free band, you must use all 50 channels between 902 and 928 in a pseudo-random manner. You're not allowed to dwell more than a few milliseconds on any one frequency. So you've got to hop to all those frequencies. The antenna's got to operate across that whole band. So he had done everything quite right, and he was able to read tags at 6 feet. Had a good radio, good antenna, good tags, he could read them at 6 feet. And the simple engineer, with the Yagi antenna that looked like it was just purely horizontally polarized, it didn't have a flat plate aimed forward. It didn't look like it had any area. The area of a Yagi is something that happens electronically. Your eye does not see it. Let me drop. So he did the side-by-side after the Intimec display of 6 feet. The simple person slowly walked away from the tag while it was beeping. You could tell when the tag is being read because the reader gives you a beeping sound. He started walking away from 4 feet, 5 feet, 6 feet, 8 feet, 10 feet, 12 feet, 14 feet, 16 feet, 18 feet, 20 feet, 22 feet, 24 feet. It finally stopped reading at 24 feet. And the competition had done everything just right, and they got 6 feet. The engineer from the competition was sitting in the audience, and he said, "That's a bunch of bull." He spent the next 3 days of that conference studying that simple technology instrument. Every hour of every day, he was fiddling with it, looking at the computer program, putting his hand in front of it, changing the tags, changing the orientation, everything. He couldn't find out where the hoax was coming from. He knew it was a hoax. If the competition had measured an extra foot out of 6 feet, he would have accepted that. Maybe the radio is a little bit more sensitive. 4 times the range. He said to himself, where the hell is that coming from? And that thing that was sitting out in front, he didn't recognize what a Yagi antenna inside of a rubber, injection molded rubber, what it looked like. He didn't recognize what a Yagi looks like. It was a very funny shaped object. And it read 4 times the distance. Where was that coming from? Let me drop it. His flat plate antenna had something like 2 to 3 dB of gain. The Yagi we were using had 6 dB of gain. That made a 3 or 4 dB improvement on transmit, 3 or 4 dB improvement on reception. So you now got 6 or 8 dB improvement from that factor. His antenna was circular polarized, which means half the power was horizontal, half the power was vertical on transmit, but the receiving antenna on the tag was linear polarized. It only received half that power. That's a 3 dB loss. The tag transmits a signal back, which is linear polarized. A linear polarized signal going into a circular polarized antenna loses another 3 dB. So he lost 3 dB on circular polarization of transmit. He lost 3 dB of circular polarization on receive. He lost 4 dB of transmit gain. He lost 4 dB of transmit receive. He put it all together and made a 4-to-1 difference in range. It was pure physics, and it wasn't a hoax. The guy from Simple who was doing that demonstration said that was the most fun he's ever had with his clothes on as an adult. Because here's the competition. For years, these two guys are going head-to-head with barcode readers, and all of a sudden, both of them get into the RFID reader business, and he had that ratio of difference because of this relatively radical Yagi-like antenna with a really funny shape that had all this performance. Go ahead, Wes, N2XJN, K2IZ.
Yeah. Antenna could be smaller, but once you are able to have that antenna broad enough, you actually not necessarily have to obey the basic features of an antenna, which is the release stage and elevation. My question is, if you have a modern antenna tuner, would that be simply not noticeable that the antenna is extremely broad, extremely narrow, but thanks to that, you actually getting all of the, almost all the properties of the big antenna or big Yagi or extremely nicely big G tune of the dipole and to exchange.
When it comes to a single dipole antenna, the real magic of its transmission and reception comes from resonance. As long as the dipole can resonate, it can be the wrong size, the wrong shape. A full-size dipole on 80 meters is 132 feet long. You could, if you want to, take that 132-foot dipole and shrink it down to 32 feet. It will have 3,000 or 4,000 ohms of capacitive reactance when you do it, and the resistive component that used to be 72 ohms will probably go down to 5 ohms. You'll get a huge standing wave ratio. But if you have the right kind of an antenna tuner, right at that antenna, and you re-resonate it and re-impedance match it, you will never lose more than half a dB of gain on transmit and receive compared to the full size. That's the so-called infinitesimal dipole phenomena, which you can read about in Krause's book. That's the book called Antennas, John Krause, W-H-A-K, McGraw-Hill, 1950. Real good book on antennas. So the infinitesimal dipole, once it's properly impedance matched at your frequency and resonated, will give you the full performance of a full-size dipole. That's true of a dipole. Let me drop. A Yagi is different. When you take an antenna where you're trying to measure more gain than a dipole, and you physically shrink it down in boom length or element length, you start running into another whole loss phenomenon. It is the refractive optic slow wave structure of the parasitic elements of a Yagi that gives it its apparent large effective capture area in its gain. You build that Yagi out of ceramic materials where you can make it physically smaller. If the whole world was filled up with that ceramic material, that gain would be real. But after that signal leaves your ceramic material and goes into air, the amount of area your antenna presents to the air is what determines what gain you're going to get. So he thought he was making a big gain by using high ceramic materials to shrink down the antenna. He lost gain in the process. On top of that, he hadn't come up with a technique for matching it across that frequency region. With modern day techniques, let me drop it. Every one of your cell phones has got an antenna inside that's much too small, that doesn't properly resonate across all those frequencies. Every one of your cell phones has got a little chip in there that really is an antenna tuner. As the cell phone goes to each one of the frequencies it's going to, it knows what frequency it's on, it sends the right command to that antenna tuner integrated circuit chip that's connected to that antenna that re-resonates that antenna. It's a dipole-like antenna. As long as it hits resonance, even though it's too small, even though it's got the wrong orientation, even though it's squeezed inside of that little package of your handheld cell phone, you get full performance of a dipole as long as it's losslessly properly resonated. But if that was a Yagi antenna in there, and you don't have anywhere near enough room to do that, you wouldn't get all that performance. You've got to have the full-size element with the full-size spacings in order to get that performance out of the Yagi. So, he could have, in theory, this was way back in 2003, in theory he could have had somebody build him an integrated circuit chip to re-resonate his antenna at each one of those frequencies, so at least he wouldn't be hitting 2-to-1 standing wave ratio at the end of the band. The reason why an RFID reader, let me backtrack. We as ham radio operators, we can tolerate an antenna with a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio. 2-to-1 standing wave ratio means 1/10 of the power is being reflected from the antenna back to the transmitter. In forward signal being transmitted, you lose half a dB. 2-to-1 Viswa is where you lose half a dB on transmit. So 2-to-1 Viswa to a ham radio operator where you lose half a dB, which means that the half a dB is 1/12 of an S unit, 6 dB per S unit. You lose 1/12 of an S unit, a forward signal on a well-calibrated S meter because of the Viswa. To a ham radio operator, that's very tolerable. When it comes to an RFID reader, which really is a CW radar, the signal it transmits that lights up the tag is the exact same signal you've got to be able to receive. So you're listening to a signal coming back from the tag at roughly minus 80 dBm, and you're transmitting a signal of 1 watt plus 30 dBm output. If the reflection of your own antenna is 2-to-1 standing wave ratio, 10 dB reflection, you're getting a signal reflecting from your own antenna. Plus 30 you're transmitting, you get minus 20, you get plus 20 back. You can't build any kind of a receiver where you put a plus 20 dBm, that's 100 milliwatts of signal. You put 100 milliwatts of signal roared into the front end of a sensitive receiver, you'll saturate the daylights out of it. You'll desense that receiver. You've got to have an extremely low standing wave ratio on your own antenna, otherwise you jam your own receiver when it comes to a one antenna handheld RFID reader. Not many people seem to know that. You need extremely low VISWAT. You need a 1.05 to 1 standing wave ratio across that 3% bandwidth. You send that out as a specification to every antenna manufacturer in the United States. Every one of them will reject it as a nut paper. They'll say that was a specification written by the purchasing department. These guys don't know what the hell they're doing.
Repeater, time out.
You go to a commercial antenna manufacturer, you tell them the spec is 2 to 1 standing wave ratio max, they'll say fine. If you're willing to pay a premium, they'll get you down to 1.5 to 1 standing wave ratio. You ask him for a 1.05 to 1 standing wave ratio across the whole band, and he'll say, what in the world are you smoking? It can't be done. He's positive it can't be done. The people who are positive it can't be done should stand out of the way of the guy who's doing it. Over to you, Wes, at 2XJN, K2RAW.
Yeah, very, very valuable information. Thank you very much for that. Many people have a problem with enough of space to put the antenna gear. But it depends what person is expecting from ham radio in his location. Whether he wants to DX or he wants just to charge on the repeater. Yeah, it's interesting discussion. Now, I have a question. Did you have the chance to look at the email that I sent you from May 25? And that was my X-ray HP modified.
I believe that Roy also made a comment on that. Is that the one that Roy made a comment on, Wes? Go ahead.
Yes, he did. But what is interesting is that there was a 10-year-old X-ray machine, not made for medical field, but it was made for the professional scientific lab. And it was modified by C-True technology. Now, what it does is this thing acts as a microscope. One of the pictures from May 25th, which was 6 days ago, you see me holding a small plug. One has two contacts, one has three contacts. And then on another picture, you see me holding that plug against the big screen. And then you see a huge 50 times magnification of how the plug was made inside. So I found that interesting enough to send it, this picture to you.
Is that the picture where there is something being circularly spun and there was a spark from that center rod out toward this brownish liquid that's being spun? Is that the same one we're talking about, Wes? Go ahead.
Okay. On that email, you have a few pictures. The first picture was just showing you the battery compartment of the flashlight and the battery inside. Another one was showing a flashlight inside the machine. The next one was me holding that plug in the, very closely so you could see how the plug is made. And then, it's a circular one, black and white. And then you have two red arrows. Those two red arrows are pointing at each one of the pins to show you how small is the pin and how big is the picture.
Yeah, what you're talking about, Dick, was the one where they were spinning mercury. That's a different one.
It's 25th, May 25th. Says my lab X-ray HP modified first test.
Now in that particular picture, you've got an X-ray of a very small pin, and What was the purpose there? Was it a method of construction that allows the pin to be small but still make good contact? What was the point being made by that one? Go ahead.